With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Welcome to episode 64 of The Hilo, the weekly news and pop culture podcast brought to you by journalist Dolly Alderton and Pandora Sykes.
How are you feeling about the cooling heatwave?
Is it cooling?
Yeah, apparently it's over, it's all over now.
God, that's really depressing. I hate it when people kept on saying it was too hot.
I'm glad it's... I think today is perfect. It's still bright and
tanning
sunny.
In. Since we last spoke, the Trump baby balloon has taken off, and my favourite picture, and boy, the choices were good, was the one of Nelson Mandela catching baby Trump as the orange balloon appeared to float into the giant statue's hands in Parliament Square. Nearly 250,000 people joined the Dump Trump march in central London, protesting against the president's visit. That's a huge turnout, no?
Yeah, enormous.
Next, there was a press conference at Chequers between Trump and Theresa May, which was described by press there as agonising. Not so much a press conference as a 50-minute couples counselling session, one in which the therapist was regrettably absent, leaving no one to mediate between two rapidly fragmenting psyches, wrote John Crace in The Guardian. Trump later suggested that Theresa May should sue the EU. And of course, the video of Trump barging in front of the Queen, leaving her to totter behind him, went viral. Have you seen that video?
No.
God, it's really shocking. One of the best tweets on that I read was this from Matthew McGregor, which has had 40,000 retweets. I'm not a monarchist by any stretch of the imagination, but this is such an insult to Britain. Absolutely clueless, thoughtless, lacking in any dignity and without a shred of respect. So it's basically the Queen tottering alone in her lilac number in that baking heat with Trump like sort of barging past her and walking in front of her without offering her an arm, without kind of deferring to her at all. And it's had a lot of coverage because it just really summed up just that complete lack of respect he has for anyone, really.
Poor old Queenie.
In most recent Trump news, he has denied that Russia has meddled in the elections, going against his own intelligence chiefs. Away from Trump, I was interested this week by some tweets from Susanna Reid.
Of course you were. Absolutely obsessed.
Have you seen these?
No.
So she wrote these in response to the increasing pressure she seems to be under to make a stand against her Good Morning Britain co-host, Piers Morgan. Half my critics think I should leave my paid employment because they take issue with the one person sitting next to me. The other half think I should leave because I take issue with the person sitting next to me. I'm staying right where I am, wrote one of them. Getting hit from left and right, criticised for being too opinionated and too quiet, accused of being a snowflake and a, see you next Tuesday, too liberal, too enabling, good looking but, my skin just gets thicker by the second, she wrote. What do you make of her facing all the criticism at the moment for co-hosting with Piers Morgan?
Well, I think, you know, it's so hard for women to find space in broadcasting. So I understand what she's saying, that this is her job and she's got to show up and she's got to take it seriously and she's got to make a living. But I do understand why people might find it problematic that she shares that space with Piers Morgan, particularly some of the stuff he says on that show. But I do think she's quite good at picking him up on it. I mean, I don't watch Sit Up Britain, but you do. But she does, doesn't she? She does hold him to account for some of the more offensive things that he says.
She does. I also think she's quite graceful. It's not her place to go on and argue on air with her presenter. And actually, when presenters do that, and there are other presenters who I find are constantly like nitpicking at their co-host, it's quite uncomfortable viewing.
Like you and I.
He is there to represent a voice. And he actually, a lot of the time, has done some quite thoughtful reading and comes up with some quite interesting points of view. A lot of the time he's also very controversial, but I don't really think that he should have to stand down any more than she should. I think they're there to represent different viewpoints. And like you say, she picks him up on it when it matters. Away from the trials and tribulations of Piers Morgan and Susanna Reid, what's been in the mailbag this week?
We got a bunch of really lovely emails for our listener whose letter we read out for Ask the Hilo last week about being a young adult orphan. And I've replied to them, but I also just want to say thank you so much for those and any more that are coming. Pandora and I were very moved by them. And with your permission, I will be sending all of those on to her.
And what have you been enjoying this week, Dolly?
I read a fabulous piece by Suzanne Moore with my coffee this morning about her upcoming 60th birthday and how we view women and age. Suzanne Moore, I'm sure you all know, is a Guardian journalist and widely thought of as one of the best journalists working today. She's a very brave writer, I think. She's admirably no-nonsense and very clean with her prose. And do check out her writing, particularly her political commentary, if you're not familiar with it. She wrote, "I gaze upon our youth, especially in this weather, as they glow with urgency, and I remember all that fondly. But I know that my time is now. The anxiety of menopause has come and gone, and let me know that my energy is now for me, that I'm responsible for my own happiness. I've spent my disposable income on getting work done, not on my face, too late, but on my brain. I went back to college. This is the only anti-aging serum I would recommend. We are told that women my age are embarrassing, while men my age are hitting their prime. But surely in this era of self-identification, we all know that inside doesn't match the outside, and I'm actually 14. Hopefully I will get the document soon. The only wisdom I have accrued is that it doesn't help to worry about what others think, as they will think it anyway. Don't act out of obligation. You're allowed to waste your own time. As Nora Ephron said of a friend who had tongue cancer and so couldn't eat a last meal, have your last meal all the time. This is how I intend to live. I'm not fooling myself or anyone else about my age. So 60, bring it on. I want all the cake." I loved it so much. And I think our attitude to ageing in this country, particularly ageing women, is something I feel very enraged about. I find it very disrespectful and very patronising, the way we speak about and treat older women. And I think this piece is a really important reminder that, to quote Hannah Gadsby, these women are in their prime and that they deserve to be heard and they deserve to be taken seriously and they deserve to be seen. So thank you very much, wonderful Suzanne Moore, for writing that, and very happy birthday to you. I also listened to Elizabeth Day's new podcast, How to Fail, which is such a good idea for a series, I think. She interviews people about three particular things that they've failed at throughout their lifetime, with the ethos of the podcast being that we learn so much more from failure than we do from our success, and yet we live in a culture that only recognises and discusses and is open about achievement. The first episode is with Phoebe Waller-Bridge, who is the actor and writer and creator of Fleabag, who I just adore. And I think it's probably the most open interview I've heard with her. And she talks about a load of different stuff. She talks about the indignity of auditioning and being an actor. She tells a very funny story of failure about when she auditioned to have a part, quite a big part, I think, in Downton Abbey. She talks about the taboo of female rage and anger and how she harnesses it, and the long disaster that is one's 20s. It's a really great conversation between two very intelligent and open-minded women, and also good friends, which I think you can hear with their chemistry. And I could have listened to it for hours. Here's a clip I particularly enjoyed when Phoebe is talking about women's fear of ageing.
The gloom of self-loathing that we're supposed to grow around us as we get older and start fearing that our value is diminishing has been the opposite experience for me, actually. I feel like there's a message from society and billboards and all that kind of stuff that is teaching us to sort of hate ourselves. And I've always felt like that was a kind of way of controlling us. And the moment I realised that, I was like, oh, you're just trying to control me. And then that flicked my rebellious switch even more. And now I just feel way more fierce than I ever did in my 20s.
Disclaimer, Dolly Alderton has also shared her own stories of failure on this podcast.
I am. All my epic failures are coming up at some point in this series. And I've also interviewed, I begged Elizabeth if I could interview her for the final episode, which I did yesterday.
That's so what journalists do when they're drunk. They just sit around interviewing each other.
Exactly. Speaking of drunk, I'm also slightly bleary-eyed, fresh off the weekend at Latitude, where I was half working, half playing. I saw some really, really brilliant comedians and performers and musicians. But one particular highlight I've discovered through the lineup of Latitude is an Irish musician called David Keenan, who I just cannot stop listening to his music. He has the most beautiful voice, and he sings in his Irish accent as well, which I love. And his songs are deeply soulful and so poetic. And he's just such an Irish musician in his lyricism. It's like proper old storytelling. And I went to look for interviews with him afterwards, and there's a great interview with him with Roisin Ingle, who's an Irish columnist who I absolutely adore. She does a podcast series called Roisin Meets with some really interesting people. The Catelyn Moran interview is also very good. And she has this long conversation with David Keenan about how he came to write music. And I don't know, maybe I fell for it hook, line and sinker, but as a folk fan, I feel like he's a proper troubadour, and I feel like he's the real thing. To a human arena, and if I lean towards the trigger, you say you can't get a killer, no. No, you can't get a killer, no. What have you been up to this week?
I've been reading The Discomfort Zone by Farah Storr. Farah is the editor of Cosmo in the UK. And this is I'd call it a work help book as opposed to a self-help book. And there are quite a few of these around at the moment. There's The Toolkit for Working Women by Atega Awagba. There's The Multi-Hyphen Method by Emma Gannon. The Discomfort Zone has a really interesting premise. And it's not something I've really seen explored elsewhere, although it really ties in with Elizabeth's podcast about, you know, failure being a really positive and like galvanizing thing. So yeah, it centers around the idea that a brief moment of discomfort is necessary and vital to success. And she talks about the danger of avoiding discomfort, the obstacle shirker, and champions the micro diversion as a way to overcome obstacles. She uses stories of successful people at every turn, which I loved, as they really help illustrate her point. For example, with the power of the micro diversion, where you sort of, yeah, you take a kind of tiny pivot to overcome that seemingly looming obstacle. She uses the story of the Royal Ballet soloist Eric Underwood. When Eric was 13 or 14 years old, growing up in America, he was from a poor household, and his mother really wanted him to get into the performing arts school because she thought it would lead to a better life. And so Eric went to try out in the, you know, on the stage to get in through his acting, and he froze. He completely froze. He forgot all of his lines, and, you know, they said, this isn't for you. But instead of completely losing out at the chance of a better education, Eric merely did a micro diversion, and he went into the ballet class for a ballet audition. And he said, I haven't studied, but I'm really great at street dancing, and I can learn and I can move. And he got into the school, and now he's the Royal Ballet soloist. So there's these really... I don't really read like work help or self-help books, but it's just such an interesting idea. And I love how she kind of packages it up with, you know, the idea of the, you know, don't be an obstacle shirker and take your micro diversion. And it's just like a really fun way to learn and to take those tools into the workplace. And I think it's something I'll come back to actually at points throughout my career. I've also been engrossed in The Caliphate, a podcast which is hosted by Rukmini Kalamachi, the foreign correspondent for the New York Times, who has been nominated for 3 Pulitzer Prizes over her career. So she's like a really kind of well-known, you know, brilliant journalist. In the podcast, Rukmini covers everything from the daily fear you live with as a foreign correspondent to what ISIS is and why and how it gained its following. A couple of riveting episodes of the podcast see her interview a Canadian ISIS fighter who has carried out 2 executions. And I was listening to a podcast last week, I can't remember if it was The Economist or The Week Unwrapped, where someone said, look, this isn't a popular opinion, in fact, it's a downright controversial one, but for many people, ISIS stabilised their lives in a day-to-day fashion, in a way that foreign forces in Syria could not and did not. And I think just in light of that comment, it's important to see terrorism from all of its sides and how these people got there, not just to see them as evil executors, but also through the eyes of the people who actually, if not permanently, found solace and found like a new career in it. And this, and these interviews with this ISIS fighter are really fascinating. On a lighter note, thank you to the Hilo listener who introduced me to Undercover Lover, the unofficial Love Island podcast from the journalist Harriet Minter. It's a weekly deep dive covering all things Love Island, and it's absolutely brilliant if you're really into Love Island. She's had lots of journalists on it, like Elizabeth Day, again, Laura Jane Williams, Hattie Crystal. It's just really fun and thoughtful. And according to some tweets I got this morning, much better than the official Love Island podcast.
Really?
Which I love that from Dolly. Oh, really? Oh, great. I will not be listening to either because she doesn't watch Love Island. In the papers this week, I loved Janice Turner's piece on humble heroes like the Thai rescue divers, the England football team, and Bill and Melinda Gates. "We are not heroes," said John Valanthin, a rescue diver, when he arrived at Heathrow. "What we do is very calculating, very calm. It's quite the opposite." And she basically compared these men who act with such kind of fortitude, but also such humility. And she compared that to the billionaire Elon Musk, who got in a huff when he was told that his mini submarine was not right to use for the Thai cave excavation. I'm just going to read out an excerpt here. "A theme of this unforgettable summer has been modesty over grandstanding, team effort over ego. I was struck this week how every England player thanked not just his fellow players, but the staff, the people who wash their kit and massage their aches. Nor did their manager consider for a moment milking national goodwill with a homecoming parade. True heroes don't showboat, embellish their reputation with flashy good deeds. They send secret checks instead of boasting about their charity work. They fly across the world for no reward. Unlike our visiting, very stable genius, they don't boast about how they're doing a fantastic job. Quietly, they hold the world together. So strike a medal for the quiet people, except they'd never wear it, they'd keep it in a drawer."
Support for the Hilo comes from Moët and Chandon. When you make wine, it's so much more than pressing grapes and letting them age. Everyone's favourite bottle of bubbles, Moët Brut Imperial, is actually made of over 100 different wines made from the three Champagne grape varieties: Pinot Noir, Pinot Meunier, and Chardonnay, that have been blended. These wines have come from a number of different harvests.
The challenge for the cellar master is making sure that no matter what, the Moët Imperial tastes the same year on year and bottle after bottle. It's like an artist who is asked to paint the exact same picture with identical colours, but who is given a different palette.
No pressure at all then. When Benoit Gouez, the cellar master, feels the harvest is exceptional, it is his time to have some fun and make a vintage champagne. A vintage champagne means that only the grapes from that harvest will be blended. This means that each one vintage is totally unique and exclusive, just when you thought champagne couldn't get any better.
Apparently 2009 was the best year for champagne in a long time. So if you've got your hands on a bottle of Moët Grand Vintage 2009, then you are set.
Thanks very much to Moët and Chandon.
It's now time for The Top Line, read by Dolly Alderton. Search high and low, so close, yet so far to go.
I just know there's a sunny day. Hollywood producers are already fighting over film rights for the Thai cave rescue story. Hollywood producer Michael Scott was seen down at the scene interviewing divers, whilst Ivanhoe Pictures has announced that it is in talks with the Thai government and Navy about a film. John Chu, the director attached to Ivanhoe Pictures, tweeted, "I refuse to let Hollywood whitewash out the Thai cave rescue story. No way, not on our watch." A plastic surgery clinic has been condemned for encouraging people with poor credit ratings to take out loans to pay for surgery. Maya, whose adverts run during the Love Island break, has been in trouble previously for an ad last year which depicted boob jobs as a confidence booster for new mums. Twitter has done a purge of its fake followers and bots, leaving Obama down by 2.35 million followers, Justin Bieber down by 2.7 million, Dolly Alderton down by 1,000, and Twitter itself shedding 7.7 million followers. Jack Dorsey has been praised for this attempt to clean up Twitter and minimise the abuse which has become rife across the platform. The United Nations has called for the unimpeded access to almost 250,000 Syrians stranded in the desert near Jordan and Israel, who fled as al-Assad's forces entered rebel-controlled parts of Daraa. The UN has called the situation dire. There is no shelter or protection from desert heat and winds, and food supplies have dwindled. It called on all warring sides to allow the passage of aid deliveries to civilians. Four members of Pussy Riot have been jailed for 15 days after running onto the pitch during the World Cup final on Sunday. The Russian activist group said it was a protest against human rights abuses in Russia. Scientists have said that warming seas are likely to bring 10 species of sharks to British waters within the next 30 years. There are already around 40 species of sharks living off the UK coast, but climate change is likely to bring new kinds from areas like the Mediterranean and African coast. A watchdog has found the Metropolitan Police is failing to record more than 94,500 crimes every year, amounting to about 10.5% of the total reported to the force by the public. The watchdog highlighted domestic abuse as among the areas that were not being adequately registered. A model has walked down the catwalk while breastfeeding her baby. At the Sports Illustrated show during Miami Swim Week, Mara Martin strutted down the catwalk in a metallic gold, one-shouldered bikini while carrying her five-month-old baby, who was wearing noise-cancelling headphones and a nappy. A mini tsunami has hit tourist beaches in parts of Mallorca and Menorca. A wave measuring nearly 5 feet hit the west coast of Menorca on Monday morning. There were no reports of any injuries, and the tsunami occurred when the beaches were largely empty before holidaymakers started to arrive for their daily dose of sun. More than 60 British rabbis have written a joint letter saying Labour has chosen to ignore the Jewish community as the party's ruling body prepares for a meeting on its anti-Semitism code of conduct. Some of the UK's most senior rabbis, in a letter to The Guardian, said Labour was acting in an insulting and arrogant way by choosing in its new code to amend an international definition of anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism within sections of the Labour Party have become so severe and widespread that we must speak out with one Jewish voice, the letter said. And that was the top line.
It is now time for our author special. Yomi Adegoke and Elizabeth Uvubenene are the authors of Slay in Your Lane, The Black Girl Bible, which was published earlier this month by Fourth Estate after a bidding war between 9 different publishers. Stuffed full of interviews with successful black British women, such as Olympic athlete Denise Lewis, politician Dawn Butler, barrister and journalist Effa Hirsch, comedian Susan Wacoma, and publisher Charmaine Lovegrove, it covers what it is to be a young black woman through education, dating, the workplace, and mental health. We are writing this as much for ourselves as we are for other black women, wrote Yomi in the foreword. But as Janice Turner wrote in an interview with you both for The Times, Slay in Your Lane should be mandatory reading for everyone. We rarely hear about black women, you write. This book, brilliantly and thoughtfully researched, stuffed full of information and anecdotes, is destined to change that. Welcome to the studio, Yomi and Elizabeth.
Hi.
Hi. First off, can you tell us a bit about how the idea for the book came about, the process of bringing it together, and what that process was like as two very close friends?
So we came up with the idea in March 2015. I was in my corporate job. It was like my first kind of like major graduate job after university. And as you do, you kind of work out like what you want to do with your career. So I kind of like looked at my boss's boss, and they were all essentially like white men. And I guess I felt a bit like, oh, okay, can I thrive in this environment? So I read like loads of personal development books, such as Lean In by Sheryl Sandberg. Though those books were great, there was a particular chapter in one of the follow-up books that she wrote that really kind of like spoke to me. It was a chapter talking about black women's place in just corporate America. And I think it was that kind of chapter in that follow-up edition in Sheryl Sandberg's book that kind of made me realise that, oh wow, there should be more than just like one chapter in this book in a follow-up edition. There should be like a whole kind of a book, essentially. And I think at that time I was kind of like in my own kind of like challenges at work. I was just trying to work out exactly what I wanted. So I essentially called Yomi on my kind of frustrated week, and as you do, your best friend. And obviously her being a journalist and writer, I was like, I think you should write a book for me, essentially. And we had a conversation, and by the end of that conversation, we decided to like to work together on the book.
Yeah, and then there was a lot of sort of, because initially when Elizabeth called me, it was like, okay, we want to talk a lot about the workplace and how you sort of navigate the workplace as a black woman. And then once we started doing research, it became clear there was just nothing about being a black British woman in any context. So whether it was like dating or health or education or within the media sort of thing. So then we were like, what's the point of like slaying in your work lane, if like your love life's just a total mess, and like if your health's a total mess, so then it just kind of expanded. And I think that's where the whole kind of like collaborative and like best friend element came in really handy, because it's like we're so different and also so similar that we had like such a clear vision, but then it's like we could always kind of see what was missing, because if one of us didn't spot it, the other one would. So it just kind of like built, like, honestly so quickly, because it was just like we just kind of been like, what about this, what about that, like, yeah.
Slay in Your Lane is at its best when discussing the myriad nuances of racism, with multiple illustrations of each. You cover microaggressions, micro assaults, micro invalidation, the white cosign, and the idea of covering, where a black woman adopts a white face to be more racially palatable. Can you talk a little bit about these kind of numerous things that you identify in the everyday struggles that a black woman might face in the workplace, or in dating, or in health, as you say, or in school?
So I'll talk a little bit about covering, which is what Funke Abimbola, one of our interviewees, a lawyer, spoke about, which I'd never sort of actually thought of. Like, I'd been sort of vaguely aware that it was something I was probably doing, but there was no kind of language for it, and I think that's one of the things that we really try to do in this book. With Funke, she was talking about covering and essentially not feeling that you can protect. I mean, I guess no one really brings their whole self to work, because then we'd just be like mad in our working spaces. But she was like talking about sort of, yeah, essentially covering by kind of putting on a face that isn't one that you, it's not a natural one, if that makes sense. It's kind of like ensuring that you are, as you said, racially palatable by sort of chipping off little bits of yourself that I suppose are too black, if that makes sense. So that's kind of like ensuring that you have the right hair in certain work environments, you speak a particular way. We speak a lot about code switching. Nobody's saying that you should bring your entire self to work, but you shouldn't feel like you have to sort of put away big bits of what makes you yourself in a drawer, essentially, and feel like things that are sort of core to your like black identity, you shouldn't feel that, you know, you're gonna sort of be held back in the workplace by sort of embracing them.
The thing about microaggressions, they're not always intentional, and I think it was important for us to kind of not see it as like, oh my God, everybody's racist, because they've said, oh, like, they're touching your hair. In that chapter, what we try to do our best is to kind of not say you have to then deal with it in terms of anger, or there are different ways to kind of, you know, navigate those spaces. Working in like, you know, Canary Wharf and a big corporate firm, I've definitely had so many kind of like little things that you end up spending your day just brushing them off. And by the end of it, you are meant to kind of do your job. And I think that was something that we went to an event and I said that, and they were like, oh my God, because you don't go to work to kind of brush off other people's little microaggressions and things like that, because they do build up and you want to progress in work, and these things don't, you know, form in a vacuum. And by the point you're trying to kind of, like Yomi spoke about, bring your most authentic and your best professional self to work, you're battling kind of like things that kind of invalidate you being there in the first place.
I think that the way you name stuff is really powerful, like the idea of the white cosign, that, you know, a young black woman at work may suggest an idea, but no one takes it seriously until, like, her white senior is like, oh, that's a really good idea.
Yeah.
I thought that was a really interesting way of putting it.
That's happened to me. Like, I've been in, like, meetings, and where I'm obviously the marketing manager, I'm leading a project, and I would say, well, this is how I feel, and this is what we should be doing, and give really structured feedback. And my kind of superior, he would, who's a white male, he would say, well, I agree with Elizabeth, and all of a sudden everyone's a bit more energetic about that particular idea or that particular piece of feedback. But what I've found is it can prove useful, inverted commas, but it's not something that I like to rely on.
Yeah.
And
you have to rely on it.
Exactly.
And also, as you said earlier, is that that grinds down on you. If that's a kind of low level constant thing, then it will really have an effect on like your sense of agency and your sense of worth and your confidence and your work.
Absolutely.
The book describes what it is to be a black woman right from the very beginning. For example, in the classroom, the main focus is on white working class boys, then a smaller focus on black boys, leaving little to no attention paid to black girls. As a result, black girls are largely rendered invisible within the education conversation, you write, Elizabeth. You write about the unconscious bias of the classroom and cite the absence of role models for black and minority ethnic children. And you endorse this with a ton of really, really meaningful statistics. One that I found particularly interesting is an American study that showed that you're more likely to succeed as a student if you look like your teacher.
And it was more profound in black girls. I think that was a bit that really like took me back. more across all different pupils, it proved to be true. But when it came to Black girls, it was even more apparent out of all the other groups. And I think that says a lot.
It says a lot about the importance of representation, yeah. Essentially. Mm.
It comes back to the you cannot be what you cannot
exactly. See,
doesn't it? Time Absolutely. And time again.
Yeah.
I mean, you guys did so much research for this book. It was unbelievably impressive, but also it just was so galvanising to your arguments. There was no like, oh, you could read that data one way or the other. This was like overwhelming data. And I don't think I've ever read a book with so much fortifying data. For example, in 2013-14, only 12% of trainee teachers were not white, whilst only 8% of university professors are not white. Mm. And of that 8%, only 0.49% are Black women. Were you shocked when you were doing this research? Or did it just, you know, endorse your feelings that like, my God, we need this book and my God, we need change?
I think it was like a combination of the two. The research is very intentional because so much of our sort of, as Black women, our fears and our kind of like, you know, we have these kind of suspicions that, you know, maybe this is because I'm Black. And but then it's been caricatured over the years because, you know, there was the whole Ali G, is it because I'm Black? Like, that's literally how our sort of worries about things and whether things are racist, that's what they've been called, kind of rendered to. So for us, it was so key and so important that whatever we were saying was backed up with as much statistical data as we could. It's so important to try and get as specific as possible because we wanted people to read it and sort of be like, look, this isn't about a chip on... Exactly, this isn't a chip on the shoulder. This isn't, you know, this made-up, imagined thing. Elizabeth talks a lot about sanity checks and just being able to see that these things aren't imagined, but then also for people that don't live within this demographic to understand that it's not made up. Mm. But I guess for us, when we're reading it, it's like a lot of it was shocking. A lot of the things around health, for instance, and like Black women being 3 times more likely to die from breast cancer. Some of the stats around education, again, really shocking to actually sort of see Black and white, but then at the same time, it's like you kind of have this weird inkling because you've been there. We're very like fortunate, we went to great universities and stuff, but there've been instances and sort of anecdotes that kind of, I think we've both kind of been underestimated when it came to grades. We've both had kind of like conversations about, you know, teachers sort of predicting grades wrong. So we've actually been there.
Yeah.
So
also, one of your contributors tells a story about how she did very similar work to
Dawn Butler.
Yeah.
Yeah, to a blonde classmate, and consistently it was just a given that the classmate would get an A and she would get a D no matter how much she did.
Yeah.
And at one point she said she talks about how they should swap their work. Yeah. And I was thinking, I wish you swapped your work because I bet the answer would have been what you thought it would be.
Exactly. And I think that's exactly why some of the stats are massively shocking and Black and white, but then others aren't, because when you are literally sort of age 7 or 8 thinking maybe we should swap our work because maybe then we'd, you know, get the right grades, that, you know, that's something that I suppose you kind of know from such an early age because you can see it yourself. We learn to pick up on these things very quickly. Mm. For instance, I'm always talking about the dating chapter and how the stats of, like, you know, Black women are more likely to be swiped left than any other group, and then that goes for within our own community, so Black men as well. Like, to again, seeing it on paper is like, whoa, that's shocking. But being a Black woman and sort of like anecdotes from friends and just hearing, like, it's not as surprising as it should be. And I think a lot of the sort of reactions we get from, like, when we do panels and we speak to people and they're like, oh my gosh, this really spoke to me and this really shocked me, a lot of the things we weren't necessarily as surprised about because we kind of, that's why we were able to get so much research, because we knew exactly what we were trying to prove and we knew exactly what we were looking for.
There's a bit where I keep thinking of time and time again, every time I was reading the book and being shocked, where you say that in 2015, David Cameron was, you know, gave a sort of address where he said, I'm really shocked that some people have to change their names to a more English sounding name when they do job applications. So every time I was reading this book and I was shocked, I was like, I'm being David Cameron again. You know, it's a really good reminder that, like, Dolly and I can be shocked, but, you know, it's not shocking to the people who have been living through it.
Yeah.
You know, and as you guys say, you're not nearly as shocked as...
Absolutely. So I was just going to say exactly with the David Cameron thing, the reason that's...
Be less so David Cameron is now my mantra.
It's so funny because it's like, well, my name's Yomi Adegoke. It's like there's no kind of like bones about where I'm from. Like, it's very clear. I mean, some people assume, oh, okay, like when they see Yomi, that I might be like Japanese or something because the name's there as well. But either way, everyone knows I'm not white. And I've considered so many times. I think even my dad had once suggested, like, oh, maybe you could try and anglicize your name when you're doing job applications. I think I had a conversation with one of my parents about it. And again, like, I remember being like, okay, when we're doing this sort of, when reading about, like, when researching, like, name blind applications for university and all that kind of stuff, it's like I knew exactly what to look for because I was like, this is something that we know happens. And when
UCAS won't do it, will they? Or some universities have agreed, but some haven't.
Some haven't, and even then...
Some companies have, so some, like...
some big firms
definitely have.
But the issue is, even if they do it, when you get to the interview, you're still black. And that's what the point that loads of people have made, which is just that it literally helps with, like... It is an idea that's, like, I think its heart's definitely in the right place, but the bottom line is institutional racism is what needs to go, because you get to the... It's like, okay, I'm going to change your name to, like... Jennifer Peters, and then you get there and you're still black. Whatever sensation, whatever like prejudice that was going to make them bin the application in the first place is still there when they see that, you know, Jennifer Peters is black. Yeah. Like, it's still there. So.
And that's why, another reason why I think that the research and the statistics are so important in the book, because I remember in one of your interviews with your experts, she talks about performativity, the problem with performativity, which is when someone says, normally who is involved in systemic racism, where all they have to say is, well, I'm not racist.
Yeah.
And that's that. That's the conversation ended. I'm not racist, and therefore... that's not examined for any longer.
Yeah.
That's why all your stories, though, of the micro-invalidation, the micro-assault, the micro-aggression, you know, all these, like, very clear labels of the nuances are so important, because you are literally you can say you're not racist, but, like, if you suggest that someone can't be at this university, or in the case of Effia, if you say, if you assume that her black male friend is a drug dealer rather than a fellow student, how... That's where the book is so powerful, because you are showing it with these numerous contributors and numerous stories from so many different women.
Yeah. And there's a lot of unlearning to do with those kind of like assumptions as well. These things are shocking, but it's not necessarily to say that you can unlearn them, because they don't form in a vacuum. It's kind of like fed to us in various things and reinforced. So it isn't, if you're not in our community, you read this book, it isn't you're racist, full stop, like, because the stats say, though. It's kind of understanding how kind of you got to that point where you are associating drug dealing with, you know, a black man.
And as you said, it's about recognising it and going, okay, so now I have to unpick this and change it about myself.
It's prompting you.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
This book is not going to make you unlearn all of those things overnight by the time you finish, you know, 120,000 words, but it's to kind of prompt you to kind of have those discussions and to kind of make you think about things a little bit differently if you're not part of the community that is speaking to directly.
Something that you mentioned earlier was sponsorship, and you write very compellingly in the book about the importance of mentors and sponsorship for women of colour, particularly in the workplace. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Sponsorship is so interesting, because before we did the research around this book, I didn't know the difference between mentoring or sponsorship at all, because I just thought they were all around the same thing. I think we speak a lot about mentoring, I guess, in the early years of your career, because that makes sense. Like, your mentor kind of tells you, oh, you've got to do this, got to stand there, got to, you know, appear this way. So they're very much directing you to kind of get to the point where you can break into these firms ultimately, or get your first foot in a career ladder. The thing about sponsorship, and I think we talk a lot around diversity and trying to get women and BAME people into like really kind of more senior roles, because they kind of like stuck after you spend a couple of years in work. A lot of them are just stuck in that middle management or below middle management. And a lot of them in our book, we speak about entrepreneurship. They go and start their own kind of things, or they leave the kind of corporate space. The thing about sponsorship, and it was really good to highlight and it opened my eyes, was you need allies within these firms to help you and pull women through. It's important, and it's so weird, but when I was doing that chapter and I was thinking about it, I didn't realize that I had a sponsor all this time. When I first got my kind of first big job, it wasn't an intentional thing. It was someone who was mentoring, but then it turned into a sponsorship where they would be like, I want you to work on this campaign. And if I didn't have that, I wouldn't necessarily be where I am in my career at all, because they were able to really kind of like showcase me to people. And I think the beauty about sponsorship when it comes to like black women and women is you need the people who are sponsoring and who are in higher positions to have those conversations when you're not there. So it's not necessarily we're all here and they're like, oh, here's Elizabeth and she's great. That's not enough. They need to be able to help you away from detractors or people, I'm not really sure about her personality, in order to kind of get to a point where someone wants to sponsor you and bat for you and really like elevate you in your career. They have to know your personal brand and what you stand for and what you're good at inside out.
You unpick the angry black woman stereotype really thoughtfully and with a really interesting mix of voices. You speak to Keisha Buchanan from the Sugar Babes about how her experiences on how she was written about and seen in the public eye compared to her white bandmate Heidi Range. Was this a recurring experience when you spoke to all these different women of colour?
Yeah, absolutely. I think Keisha's story was particularly sort of, harrowing, because when growing up I'd always kind of sort of been aware of the fact that she was always considered the one that was bullying Heidi. She was considered,
she was the reason that the band looked nothing
when
you were
like
writing
it
about it.
Initially.
I was like, that's so true. Yeah. And Mucha was always the moody one, and Heidi was like the baby angel.
But I remember, like, this is what's, you know, I remember swallowing that, like,
as a black woman, she was my favorite, because I was like, oh my god, she looks like me, and like, yeah, I absolutely loved Keisha, but I wasn't arguing that she wasn't a bully, because that's all I'd heard. And essentially, the fact that she'd kind of been credited for like the continued dismantling of the band, because it was like, okay, a new person's coming and she bullied them and then she bullied this new person. So honestly, when it came to interviewing her, like, I genuinely was quite nervous, like, oh god, what's she gonna be like? And like, she really was just like the most softly spoken, like, nicest, like, most lovely woman ever. And what really kind of almost, like, yeah, I would say embarrassed me was that when I was interviewing her about it and sort of asking her, you know, like, so where did these like rumors sort of come from, it was embarrassing because neither of us could really pinpoint any kind of incident that would have led to these kind of accusations. She was talking about how Megan and McKenna from TOWIE and X on the Beach, how she has like literally been celebrated essentially for being like, she goes off all the time, she's got a really bad sort of temper.
All of it, Gemma Collins.
Exactly, yeah. Diva ship. Love Gemma though.
But I absolutely love her.
Jolly loves the GC. She doesn't even watch TOWIE, but she's obsessed with the meme of Gemma, aren't you?
Yeah, totally.
But it's interesting when you say that, when you think of the double standard. I wonder if people would love and celebrate that divaness and that anger in her if she were a woman of colour.
Yeah, Megan hits the roof. You're absolutely right, and I'm thinking about it. Yeah, she's just a bit like spicy.
Yeah, exactly. That's what people would say. We see her as being like a strong woman, and we see it as part of her, I suppose, having character and being like interesting, to be honest, because so many of her TOWIE castmates are so kind of like, you know, just the opposite of that. And I think people quite like her and take to her because she's quite like forthright and confident. And I personally really liked Megan because I thought, oh, she's interesting. But I also liked Keisha, right? And I've also liked black women that are more complex and more multifaceted and, you know, not necessarily so sort of like palatable and nice, in inverted commas. But the interesting thing about Keisha, she really is like, she's just so lovely. And she was just like, I don't even know what the story was that, inverted commas, broke, that has said that I have done any of these things, and neither of us could trace it back. And she was like, it's just so interesting that Megan, who we've continually seen, like, you know, she's been in physical altercations, she's been in physical fights on television, and like, you know, it's helped her launch like a restaurant and a beauty range and a music career. And Keisha, it's like, no one has ever, like, physically, like, in the media anyway, ever seen her sort of have a temper tantrum or sort of lash out.
Even that her anger was invalidated by the media, it's that it was never actually
it was created
there.
Exactly. And that's the thing. And she was like, it's fascinating to her that, like, despite such, like, not even little evidence, no evidence, it was just so easy for everyone to go with. And she was talking about Mitya as well, and the fact that Mitya sort of being like ethnic and sort of being, you know, piercings, tattoos, soulful voice, so people kind of categorise her often as black as well. She was like, it was very much those two were like the angry, you know, women essentially.
You say in the book, there's someone, is it a friend of yours that's showing a potential intern around work?
Yeah.
And you already knew that she wasn't going to get the job because she was too loud.
She was too, she had a big personality, so she had life in her. And I said to my friend, well, I know you as someone who also has life in you. Like, what personality are you showing me that you're not showing them? And she was like, because I had the most dulled down personality when I go into work. And what we spoke about covering, she's like the most dulled down version of herself when she's in that environment.
So if she was white with the loud personality, she would be like kooky.
Yeah, exactly.
But a girl with a similarly loud personality who was black, it would be too much.
Yeah,
too full on.
It becomes, intimidating.
Exactly. And and this is where we speak about the unwritten rules about getting ahead. So no matter how smart that girl is, that intern, and how great she is, the unwritten rule as a black woman in that environment is to really
assimilate.
Exactly. And shimmer down and just be a bit more cautious with how you say things and what you say, because read your emails like 10 times. So if you disagree, it can, so it doesn't come across, you know, you're being rude, like put loads of kisses.
It's like, just completely exhausting, yeah, having and to check yourself at every day. The chapter on dating I really enjoyed, and you mentioned it earlier. Well, I really enjoyed it in the context of this year's Love Island.
Yeah.
Because I've been watching that, you obviously didn't write it about this year.
I know.
But there's been a lot of discussion around Samira and being the only...
I kind of wish I'd written it a year later.
Definitely write a piece about it, write a piece about it now.
I have, yeah.
Oh, have you?
Yeah, I did.
Okay, I will go and do my research and read that piece. But yeah, the idea that black women are considered sometimes the lowest common denominator in the dating pool. And I read a really interesting piece on Samira saying it's not just putting a black woman into Love Island. There was only one as well.
Yeah.
It was having men there that find black women attractive.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a really interesting way of putting it, is diversity is not just about having the person there.
Yeah.
It's about having the people who are open
to those
people. Are you watching Love Island, and what do you make of Samira?
Oh my God, of course we're watching Love Island. And we're one of these like originals that have been watching it since like, you know, 2014,
15. We're an original. Like, I didn't watch the first series.
Oh my God, the first was a really good one.
This season hasn't been great.
Yeah, this has been the worst of
I think the Samira stuff is really...
Yeah, it's taken...
Interesting.
To be honest, I think it's made it more difficult to watch in some ways, because it's kind of like... politicized it in a way that like we used to just watch it like completely devoid of any sort of commentary or just like, oh, bants, whereas now it's like, oh gosh, this has actually like gotten quite serious. And I think with the Samira stuff, like that point you just made about like, you know, people have been saying a lot about it's not just about diversity, it's about inclusion, and I definitely agree with that. I just think the issue with around it is that it means uncomfortable conversations surrounding preference have to be had, and I don't know if we're necessarily ready for it. And I've said this a lot of times, that like, when we say that black women are swiped left more than any other ethnic group, that's within our own community as well, and that's amongst black men, that's amongst Asian men, that's amongst white men. And I was saying this literally yesterday on a panel, that nobody's trying to say that like off the back of like reading Stay in Your Lane you have to literally find the darkest black woman you can find and be like, oh, I'm declare your love to her and propose. But I feel like preferences are something that like they are yours, and they're not for anybody to necessarily like interrogate. But I do think that it's very much about acknowledging where they come from and why.
Exactly.
They do not form in a vacuum. And I think one of the weird things around preference is it very much is considered something that you are just born with, in terms of like attract who you find attractive physically. So not in terms of sexuality, but in terms of who, what your type is. And we really have this weird ingrained idea that it's like we are born and, you know, you just happen to love like blonde hair and blue eyes and that's it.
It has to be part constructed if you look at porn culture and the damage that has had.
Exactly. And I think especially when you look around, like one of the reasons it's so obviously a constructed thing is that we looked at this documentary called Is Love Racist, with Emma Dabiri, and it was saying that that every single other ethnic group veered towards whiteness. So that's Asian people, that's mixed race people, that's black people, every single group.
That was what was so interesting, is that you were saying, you know, when someone came up to you in the club, Yumi, and said, you're the prettiest black girl in this club,
and
then you say, and he was black.
Yeah.
And I think that's, and I think that's what made this chapter so much more interesting, because it wasn't just like, oh, white men need to find black women attractive.
No way.
It was like, hold on, there is a whole...
And it's uncomfortable, because I think nobody likes to... And I think the thing that's really interesting about it, because it goes so deep into how we view attractiveness and femininity, because... I mean, I think a lot of people sort of used Samira as, because Samira's preference was white men, and she was quite vocal about liking blondes and men with green eyes and stuff. But statistically speaking, she's an anomaly. Most black women are quite happy to date black men. It's something that is the other way around where the issue lies. So black people date interracially more than any other ethnic group, but it's specifically black men. And I think it's really important to understand why that is. It's because of what we see as feminine and what we see as masculine. So black men being sort of like dark skinned and like having broader noses and curlier hair and like, you know, having more phenotypically African features, inverted commas, as much as there's all kinds of issues in terms of how they're perceived, hyper masculinity, hypersexuality, and all that kind of stuff, the reason it doesn't, black women don't look at black men and find them unattractive, is because those are features that they attribute to masculinity.
Yes.
But when you see those features on a black woman, so like me and Elizabeth with like bigger noses, bigger lips, darker skin, people see that as masculine. So what happens is you get a lot of black women being like, well, of course I want a dark-skinned man because that means he's more manly. And then when you get a dark-skinned woman, it's black men being like, oh, well, then that means she's manly. That, like, for instance, with Serena Williams, there's a whole, now everyone's kind of like, oh, she's beautiful. But there was a whole commentary where before people were like, oh, Serena's a little bit masculine.
It's slightly worrying about masculine. That commentary as well, is that I feel like people are calling her beautiful now she's married with a child.
Yeah.
It felt, it felt like she was legitimised in her beauty by a white man.
But
exactly. And by motherhood.
Yeah. Exactly. Whereas before, the commentary was like, she looks masculine. And I think that's the issue, because we talk a lot about colorism, so preferential treatment based on how your proximity to whiteness, so how light your skin is, how loose your curls are, and all that kind of stuff. And I think I'm always trying to drive home the point that this is something that affects black women more keenly, because black women with darker skin are seen as more masculine, therefore less attractive. Mm-hmm. And also, we have to remember that men's worth in this world, not even in this country, in this world, is not as heavily based on attractiveness. So when you're a woman, you have to be beautiful. And when the understanding of what is beautiful is basically whiteness, and then, okay, so you're not quite blonde hair, blue eyes, so then you've got women that are kind of light skin with curlier hair, they're like sort of slightly higher up. And then at the bottom of the rung, you've got the like black girls, inverted commas, that look like me and Elizabeth. And I think, yeah, it's important to understand that these messages about what is beautiful, they don't just live within the white community, they seep into the black community.
Well, you write as well that diversity is often seen as a biracial woman with European features.
Absolutely.
There's still that, like, we'll be a bit diverse, absolutely, but not, like, totally.
But that's just the palatable, it's, you know, we always say that it's the palatable face of blackness. And that's why, you know, things like Black Panther should not have been as revolutionary as it was, to have someone as flipping stunning as Lupita Nyong'o as a love interest. But it was, we were like, whoa, look how dark she is and look how short and curly her hair is, when in reality she's stunning. It shouldn't really make us balk and be celebrate that a black man, a black dark-skinned man, is with a black dark-skinned woman. We wouldn't like throw a big party if like a white man and a white woman are paired up in a film. It's just normal, essentially.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You talk about fetishization of black women and the appropriation by white women of black female characteristics. Yeah. It's something we see reflected in pop culture right now, namely via the Kardashians. Is this appropriation dangerous?
Cultural appropriation is such a difficult conversation to have, because I always say that in an ideal world, everybody would just be able to do and wear and enjoy everything.
And borrow off each other.
Of course.
But the whole point is, we're not in a world where that can happen, like, in a fair and respectful way.
Absolutely, we're not. Exactly. And it's like, you know, like, we're Nigerian, and it's like, you know, lots of the fabrics that we wear, Dutch wax cloth, it's like really, really famous in West Africa. And for all my life, I thought it was Nigerian. And then I found out, obviously, the name Dutch. I was like, oh gosh, so it's not, kind of thing. So if it wasn't for not cultural appropriation, but if it wasn't for that borrowing and lending and bleeding into of cultures, then a big staple part of my culture wouldn't exist, essentially. So I think in an ideal world, that would be great. But I think the problem is, I've never really had the issue with the borrowing and the bleeding of cultures. It's my biggest issue has always been that the value of something changes when a white person has it or wears it. That's always been my issue. So, for instance, kids being suspended from school for wearing cameos or having braids or hairstyles that are more sort of worn within the black community and black girls wear. And then, you know, there's a big issue in terms of the workplace. And like, there's loads of examples in the books of women in professional settings being told that they can't have braids, being told that they can't have cameos. And then a few years pass, and then the Kardashians or whoever else decide that they're going to wear cameos, and suddenly
with her Bo Derek quote-unquote braids.
Exactly, Bo Derek braids. And suddenly the value of cameos has like skyrocketed, and it's something that can be seen as fashionable and desirable and attractive and worn in a professional setting. And I think that's the problem, is it depends on who wears it. I remember somebody said something that, like, you know, what is it that makes piercings, nose piercings, red hair and tattoos on a white girl alternative and then the very same body modifications on a black girl ghetto. And I was like, that just summarizes it perfectly, that like if I was to put right now like a purple streak in my hair and go to work, I'd probably be seen as like ratchet or some a ghetto girl from Croydon that's just, you know, like decided to do this madness with her hair. But then if a white girl was to wear it, it's like, oh wow, she's manic pixie dream,
she's a rock chick.
Chick, exactly. And I think I think whilst the borrowing and the whilst the like bleeding into each other is like, I honestly think it's great. I think the biggest issue is just that A, the value changes dependent on who's wearing it, the way it's perceived in the world, it changes dependent on who's wearing it. And I think probably the worst thing is that the people that essentially popularized it first and never sort of given their due credit.
Exactly.
Credit is a big one. So like when it comes to things like, I think there's a big thing around, you know, really sort of gaudy like rhinestoned nails, which obviously anybody that's like lived in Croydon or any part of like, you know, South London for like whatever period of time, they've always been really popular to have like these really long kind of like what people would call like yardie nails of like, you know, massive like neon colours and stuff. And then there was a period like over the last few years where that became really fashionable, but it became this whole check out these new nails that we've discovered. And it's that, that's why people used to call, before cultural appropriation became the term, people used to call it Columbizing, because of that Christopher Columbus rocking up and discovering this nation that already existed. So it's that thing of Camrose being invented in this whole 2015, like in 2015 when it became this big, like twerking for instance, when Miley Cyrus, it was like she's invented twerking, and it's like she actually hasn't. This is something that if you listen to like songs from the 90s, they're singing about all the time. So I think that's, it's those issues about credit, and I don't want to wear something and it's considered tacky on me. And then if someone white wears it, it's, I've always said that like the name Shaniqua, if like, I think the first time I wrote about cultural appropriation, I said something like, the name Shaniqua, if Alexa Chung had a child, because she's like so fashionable and like beloved, like if she had a kid and she was like, I'm going to call my child Shaniqua, all the negative connotations of the name would probably just melt away, and it'd be like, Shaniqua's this brand new, cool, like quirky name. Yeah.
So that's a really interesting example. You talk a little bit about slim thick as well, about that body type being espoused kind of by lots of white girls in popular culture now. And it's something you see on Instagram as well, even down to the way a lot of kind of Instagram models are like sitting or wearing their clothes, or even like literally maneuvering parts of their body. So it looks like they're really encompassing that body type, which obviously is borrowing from a black body type.
Mm. But not only Instagram models, I think even brands, I think that's the bit that's starting to really annoy me. So I won't name it. I won't name the brands, but
if you want. We ain't sponsored by them.
What's this Fashion Nova? You've got Misguided, you've got Boohoo. If you go on their pages, they all look like versions of Kim Kardashian's like younger self. You hardly see any black models, and they're meant to look like black women, but just not have a darker hue skin. Yeah. And that's I think that's the bit that I just find a bit more troubling. And I think as someone who's on their website, that's a big turn off now.
That's the thing that really like hurts, if anything. It's like the best bits of black girls. Like it's literally like you've got a Mr. Potato Head, and then you're just like plucking, like, we definitely don't like your noses. So like black girls,
but we'll take your bum.
Exactly, we'll take your bum. You can keep the nose, we can take the lips, you can definitely keep the hair, but we can take the hairstyles. And then like, do you know what I mean? It's like just plucking of certain bits but then keep the skin tone 100%.
Much has been made of the advances in black beauty recently, and yet a lot of it does seem to be mere lip service. The whitewashing of coloured women, you write, is still rife, and whilst diverse campaigns are being shot, the makeup for those very women is not readily available. For example, Jordan Dunn was the face of Maybelline, but she wouldn't have been able to walk into a store and buy the right colour foundation for her skin because only the 6 lightest shades were stocked. Why do you think, given that Rihanna's Fenty Beauty Foundation lauded for its 40 shade strong collection and the fact that it's always selling out in the darkest shades, why do you think that the beauty industry is so slow to progress in a kind of wider mainstream sense?
Elizabeth actually told me about this, because remember that you're quoted in my chapter about the distribution thing.
Yeah, I think the thing about Fenty is only stocked in like House of Fraser, isn't it House of Fraser?
Harvey Nichols. So, and there's queues around the block.
And you won't necessarily get that in Harvey Nichols, like one in, I guess even Birmingham, it's like one in Birmingham. I don't think it's not really the most popular store. The average kind of like Superdrug or Boots, they're everywhere, essentially every high street. So in terms of like the distribution, so the marketing campaigns may be kind of like, oh, we have all these, you know, diversity, so L'Oreal, but when you go into like your local Superdrug, it's just in terms of space, they're just not going to stock it. They may stock it, but it may be in a drawer. So in terms of that distribution element, the marketing may be great, But if they're not getting the distribution into stores where they stock all of the shades, it's never going to be the same. So like Bobbi Brown, I've gone to like their store and they will have like, let's say 5 shades, and let's say they have 20 shades, and they will have backups of like the 10 shades. So they have loads of reams of like white girls who can necessarily use those shades. But when it came to like the darker shades, they'll probably stock maybe 3 of each. So once it's out, it's out. And then you've got to wait another like week for them to order it from the actual like warehouse. So it's I think that's more logistical in terms of the actual change. So when you watch your ads and stuff like that, that's kind of like diverse, and you've got Jordan Dunn fronting it, which is great. But the average person, when they go into a store, it's just not there. That's because they can choose not to stock it.
Mm-hmm. Did your research suggest that they claimed that there was not an audience for it, or just that they didn't want to be seen to be stocking it? Did it point one way or a bit to both?
I think it kind of pointed a bit to both, actually. I guess in some places they kind of talk about a lack of sort of audience, essentially, or like a lack of people that would be able to buy it. But then one of the reasons I'm like, it must at some point, the conversation must be like, do you just not want to stock this kind of thing? Because in areas like Croydon, where we live, it's gotten slightly better over the past recent years. But the fact that there were issues in terms of being able to just go to our local Superdrug or go to our local Boots and just pick up foundation that matched our skin tone, when it's a borough that either got the most Caribbean people in the country or something like that, or it's like basically a 50% BAME borough. So to actually argue that, you know, oh yeah, we're not 100% sure if there'd be a market or an audience, just literally isn't
just
true.
Crap, yeah.
It's just absolutely not true. I know there was initially something about Lux brands feeling like perhaps, what is it, maybe black women can't necessarily afford to buy things that are sort of more high-end in terms of makeup and stuff like that. And one of the reasons that when Christian Louboutin released this isn't makeup, but obviously just about like skin tone and stuff, when he released those shoes that were all like different sort of skin tones, people were so sort of excited about it, because obviously lubes aren't cheap, but it was sort of preempting that black women did have the money and did have the spend to be able to buy sort of Lux items, essentially. I would definitely say that it's kind of gone both ways. And I think what's really interesting is, like, I wrote that chapter like 2015, 2016. It was like the first chapter we ever did. And so much has changed since then. I would genuinely say for the better, and I genuinely say completely down to Rihanna, because Fenty Beauty, it's like I'd already written it and I had to literally go back and just write that Fenty Beauty had happened, because obviously off the back of that, it's like so many brands have been like, not even just in terms of their marketing, but being like
the cultural impact of that makeup brand,
crazy, just extending that. It became the whole new thing to just be like, we've extended our line by like 50 different shades and blah blah blah. And yeah, as I said, even in sort of local like Superdrugs and Boots, it's definitely easier. But as Elizabeth said, they are still more likely to overstock on certain shades and then understock on like the darker shades, which is so strange, because it's just like the likelihood of black women buying things in this branch is literally if not more the same as if the white women in certain boroughs. I think it definitely makes sense in certain boroughs where it's like, okay, it's predominantly white, for you to be like, oh okay, perhaps we don't need quite so many dark foundation shades. But the reason, I think what really just proves it, are the highly densely ethnic areas, boroughs and areas that just kind of disprove that theory altogether.
This book will be an extraordinary help to so many women of colour, particularly young women of colour moving into adulthood, who are trying to kind of make sense of the world and understand it. But this book wasn't around for you two when you were teenagers, and we were wondering if you could go back to your younger selves, knowing everything that you know now, with all the research that you've done and all the experiences that you've had, what would you say to them?
Gosh, to younger me, I guess,
or a younger Elizabeth, if that's easier.
I guess that there's nothing honestly wrong with thinking that things are racist and thinking that things are sexist. Because I think when I was really, really growing up, it's like I almost felt smarter when I was like a teenager for not thinking things were racist or sexist. Like not putting things that blatantly were down to race. But I felt better for not doing that, because I felt like, as I said, that whole Ali G, is it because I was black thing, I felt like it perhaps made me better or smarter to just be like, oh, well, not everything's about race, when a lot of it is, sadly, in this country. And I think it was only when I went to university, and I always say that the book that like literally radicalized me, which was called Patricia Hills Collins's Black Feminist Thought, when I read that, it was like a for a module at uni, it was, I remember literally leaving like the lecture theatre and being like, oh my goodness, like so much stuff that I didn't even realise was going on or happening to me, like had been, and that it was not only not a bad thing, but it was important to talk about the fact that these things often happened to me because I was black and because I was female, and sometimes because I was both at the same time. So yeah, I guess honestly, if I was going back to like young kind of like 13 year old Yomi, I'd just be like, it matters to be proud to be black because I live in a world which tells me I shouldn't be. Mm. Like, being proud to be white isn't something, no one's trying to make white people feel bad about being white or feel embarrassed. Yes. Or feel like, but being black is something that, like, yeah, it's got, like, it had and has, like, loads of stigma around it. So that's why black pride was a thing. So yeah, I think looking back, I honestly would just try to tell myself that, like, sometimes things are about race and it doesn't make you any smarter or any kind of, like, more progressive to pretend it's not, because it is sometimes, in the same way sometimes things are about sexism and whatever else, and whether I ignore it or not, it doesn't stop it from being the case.
No, I definitely agree with everything Yomi said. I think that this book is, in terms of people who are, they read it in terms of coming of age and they're younger, I think it's for them to understand that there are women who've experienced these things and they are paving the way for you to achieve those things as well as more. I think it's for guidance to let them know that they're not alone in this world, in terms of if they don't have, like, you know, an older sister or younger sister. I didn't have older sisters, so I was always looking for kind of like older women to kind of validate like who I am and stuff. So I think it'll just give them a better grounding of like their identity in this world, and they're not meant to just be, you know, in the sidelines or not achieve great things or just be, I guess, everybody's kind of like sounding board, and they are forming identities and they can achieve what they want to achieve, essentially.
Elizabeth and Yomi, thank you so much for coming on the show, and congratulations on your totally brilliant book. Slay in Your Lane is published by Fourth Estate and is out now.
Thank you very much to everyone who listened to the Hilo. Don't forget to rate, review and subscribe. It helps other people find us and boosts us in the iTunes charts. You can email us thehiloshow@gmail.com or tweet us @thehiloshow. Bye-bye.
Bye.